Commonwealth Field. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons claiming business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, but the court is now in session. God save the United States and the Commonwealth Court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant David W. Turner II, ACM S32317. Appellant presents two issues for consideration during arguments today. Excuse me. They are, one, whether the military judge abused his discretion by not recusing himself sua sponte, and two, whether the circumstances in this case create the appearance that the Special Victims Council, a person subject to the UCMJ, attempted by unauthorized means to influence the action of the military judge in reaching the findings or sentence. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I request to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Major Kenny. I'm joined by Lieutenant Colonel McHugh. We represent Staff Sergeant Turner. The facts of this case are that before trial began, the military judge met ex parte with the victim's Special Victims Council. The Special Victims Council told the judge that that Sergeant Turner's Civilian Defense Council had engaged in conduct during the pretrial interview that was that was mistreatment of some sort and that it was repetitive. The military judge and the Special Victims Council did not disclose the nature of this communication to Staff Sergeant Turner at trial. They did not disclose the nature of this communication when Staff Sergeant Turner elected to be tried by that judge sitting alone. They did not disclose that communication when Staff Sergeant Turner elected to litigate his case before that judge sitting alone. Instead, the trial judge told Staff Sergeant Turner that that they'd had a meeting, the SVC and the trial judge, but that the meeting only dealt with administrative matters. At the conclusion of trial, at the request of the defense, the trial judge made a special finding that the victim in this case was credible. But the trial judge had not forgotten that pretrial conversation with the Special Victims Council, because at the end of trial, during post-trial feedback, the trial judge discussed the alleged mistreatment of the victim during pretrial interviews when he had feedback with the Trial Defense Council. So those are the facts that give rise to these two issues. The first issue, the controlling case, is U.S. v. Quintanilla, which is 56 MJ37, as cited in the briefs. The test is that a military judge is required to disqualify themselves when their impartiality might reasonably be questioned, and that is judged from the viewpoint of a reasonable observer of the proceedings. And in this case, a reasonable observer would question the impartiality of this trial judge because the judge gave the victim, through her counsel, access to his chambers that he did not give either of the parties in the case. The defense counsel could not have engaged in such a conversation with the trial judge without it being improper. Neither could the prosecutor. But the judge gave the Special Victims Council access that he did not give anyone else. That is a violation of Canon 2B of the Air Force Code of Judicial Conduct, which states that nor shall a judge convey or permit others to convey the impression that they are in a special position to influence the judge. Another reason that a reasonable observer might question the judge's impartiality is because the discussion went beyond the mere scheduling, administrative, or emergency purposes for which ex parte communications are allowed in the Air Force practice. Talking a witness to meet ex parte with a trial judge prior to trial to discuss her mistreatment at the hands of defense counsel, whether that occurs in person or through counsel is irrelevant. And that is beyond mere administrative matters. In Quintanilla, the ex parte discussion that was found to be offensive was a conversation between the trial counsel and the military judge about the order of witnesses. If such a conversation about the mere order of witnesses is deemed to be not merely administrative, then certainly a victim communicating with the trial judge ex parte before trial about alleged mistreatment runs afoul. The next thing that a reasonable observer would have seen was the fact that the trial judge did not disclose the nature of those communications and instead affirmatively asserted on the record that the communications with the Special Victims Council were merely administrative. A reasonable observer would find that to be suspect and concerning and would question the judge's impartiality because of it.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to your assertion that the Special Victims Council in this case was bringing alleged mistreatment by the Trial Defense Council to the attention of the military judge.
Yes, Your Honor.
What would you point to in the record to indicate that Special Victims Council was characterizing this as abusive behavior or mistreatment as opposed to merely some issue or disagreement with the conduct of the interview?
Well, Your Honor, I would point to the testimony of the Special Victims Council in the post-trial 39A session that was ordered by the convening authority. The testimony that the Special Victims Council gave at that time was that, and we may not know the motives of the Special Victims Council in bringing this to light, but the Special Victims Council testified that that he did disclose to the trial judge that the nature of defense counsel's treatment of the victim was repetitive, that the questioning was repetitive. There doesn't appear that the Special Victims Council had any legitimate purpose for bringing that to light. He did not ask the trial judge to fashion a remedy for that. He wasn't asking the trial judge to intervene on behalf of his client. He was informing the trial judge of this alleged mistreatment by the Trial Defense Council and wasn't seeking remedy. A reasonable person observing those facts would reach the conclusion that his intent was to influence the trial judge's deliberations, which gets to the fourth way that a reasonable observer would find that the trial judge's impartiality was questioned, because in this case, the trial judge actually made a special finding at the request of the defense that the victim in this case was credible. A reasonable observer would suspect that that finding of credibility was influenced by the ex parte information that came to the trial judge's attention. The fact that the victim was made to weather potentially oppressive questioning by trial defense counsel prior to trial and yet persisted in the prosecution and assisted the government in bringing its case to trial would tend to suggest that victim is more credible. That was information improperly brought to the attention of the trial judge. And a reasonable observer would have concerns about the trial judge's impartiality, specifically when the trial judge later finds the victim to be credible.
At some point, counsel, wasn't access to this witness, maybe not the specifics of the interview, wasn't this issue brought to the attention of the judge in the pretrial 802 session with the parties?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't quite understand.
Wasn't this issue or this matter involving access to the victim or witness in this case, wasn't that brought to the military judge's attention in the pretrial 802 before his meeting with the SVC?
I'm not certain of that, Your Honor. It appears from the trial judge's testimony at the post-trial 39A that there was a discussion after trial with the Civilian Trial Defense Council concerning access to the witness. To the extent that it was discussed prior to trial, I don't think the record is entirely clear on that point, which would be a problem for the trial judge. It was the trial judge's responsibility to ensure that the record before this court is complete as to his ex parte communications with the Special Victims Council and his communications with counsel for the parties. And that's an important point, Your Honor, because in Quintanilla, The That record was also unclear because the trial judge had just put a witness on the stand to testify about his ex parte communications with the judge rather than giving a detailed recitation on the record from the judge himself. And that was found to be problematic in Quintanilla. It's a responsibility of the trial judge to chronicle the exact nature of that communication for Sergeant Turner, so that he can make the decisions he needs to make regarding forum choice, regarding whether to plead guilty or not guilty. Those were responsibilities of the trial judge to disclose and not to rely upon the communications through third parties by having the SBC, for example, in this case, state that he had engaged in no conduct, which might tend to disqualify him, and confirm that they'd had a discussion about administrative matters. The trial judge had an affirmative duty to make sure the record was complete. So those are the reasons that a reasonable observer would question the trial judge's impartiality, which then we move to the question of prejudice. Staff Sergeant Turner has a constitutional right to a judge that is both impartial and appears impartial. A reasonable observer would think that Staff Sergeant Turner did not receive that, that the trial judge was partial to the complaining witness in this case. And that in and of itself is prejudice that requires a remedy. Now, then we move on to the Liljeburg standard that the Supreme Court provided and that has been brought into the military jurisdiction through Quintanilla, that this court is not tied, its hands are not tied in the sort of remedy it can adjudge for failure, that you would consider three factors. The three factors are the risk of injustice to the parties in this case, the risk of injustice to parties in other cases if you did not act, and then the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process. And the Supreme Court cautioned that appellate courts must continuously bear in mind that to perform the high function, perform its high function in the best way, justice must satisfy the appearance of justice. It is not enough for the judge merely to be unbiased. He must appear unbiased. The risk of injustice to the parties in this case, this court cannot be certain that the trial judge's finding that the complaining witness was credible was not informed by improper ex parte information. And the government bears the burden of proving to this court beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not so influenced. And because this court cannot be convinced of that, the only appropriate remedy is dismissal of the charge. That leaves the question of with prejudice or without. And as you know from our briefs, we're asking for dismissal with prejudice. The reason we're asking for dismissal with prejudice comes down to the other two Liljeburg factors, the first one being the danger of prejudice to other accused in other cases is the second Liljeburg standard. The problem in this case is that the Special Victims Council testified during the post-trial 39A that this is a standard in practice.
For whom?
The context in which he offered that testimony suggested that it was a standard in practice for Special Victims Council, not for that individual counsel, but for all Special Victims Council. He did not explicitly say that, and we concede that, but the context in which he offered that testimony indicates that that was a standard in practice for the Special Victims Council program. The government did not challenge that. The government did not offer rebuttal evidence. They did not cross-examine him on that question. So the evidence in the record before this court is that that is a standard in practice. And if the government wished to establish that that was just one rogue SBC's practices, it was incumbent on the government to produce that evidence. But they did not. Their SBC testified this was a standard in practice. So if this court were not to adjudge a sufficiently strident remedy, then there is a danger that that standard in practice will continue. The third Liljeburg standard is the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process if this court were not to adjudge a sufficiently strident remedy. The retrying this case is not barred by the Double Jeopardy Clause. But the principles behind the Double Jeopardy Clause still apply. And the American public expects that the United States government should get one shot at someone, one shot to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And that when the government has caused an unfair trial, the principles behind the Double Jeopardy Clause are such that they should not get a do-over. That, from our perspective, is the most compelling argument for dismissal with prejudice. That it is unfair to make Sergeant Turner bear the indignity of being accused again. It is unfair to make Sergeant Turner have to stand and be accused and another court-martial on the same charge, when it is not his fault that the government failed to give him a fair trial the first time. That is the strongest argument for dismissal with prejudice, that this was entirely preventable. The government could have prevented this, and it is not Sergeant Turner's fault that they failed to. Absent further questions on that issue, I'll move to the unlawful influence issue. Appellant's burden on this issue is, according to Stombaugh, which was brought up by government counsel, the burden is low, but it must be more than a bare allegation or mere speculation. And our burden is to allege sufficient facts which would constitute a violation of Article 37, to show that the proceedings were unfair and that the violation of Article 37 is the reason the proceedings were unfair.
Counsel, before we get into burdens, whether or not they shift, can you please just address what you believe to be our standard of review of this issue is?
Well, Your Honor, I believe you review this issue de novo. It is true there was no motion filed at trial to traditionally preserve the UCI issue, but that is because the trial judge and the Special Victims Council failed to disclose sufficient information upon which appellant could have raised a motion to challenge the Special Victims Council's attempts to influence the trial judge in this case. So it was not directly preserved because there was no objection filed, but there was no objection filed because there was no disclosure upon which an objection could have been made. And so this court reviews this question de novo. And we satisfy our burden to show sufficient facts which constitute a violation of Article 37 because the Special Victims Council is I don't believe it's contested that the Special Victims Council is a person subject to the code. They clearly had ex parte communications with the trial judge in which they relayed information that was beyond merely administrative information. And so that is an improper way of interacting with the court martial. And in doing so, they relayed information that had relevance to the credibility of the complainant, and the judge made a finding regarding that complainant's credibility. And so we've raised this issue as the appearance of UCI. But I would posit to you that there's been actual unlawful influence, that the circumstances suggest that the Special Victims Council had no purpose other than to bring, to complain about his client's treatment to the trial judge, that information could make the trial judge find the victim to be more credible, and the trial judge then made a finding that the victim was credible. Those facts establish circumstances that establish actual influence upon the court.
So, counsel, I believe your brief describes this as a matter of an issue of unlawful command influence, but you haven't used that term in your argument thus far. The government certainly makes that distinction between unlawful command influence and other types of unlawful influence. So how do you view that issue?
The question of whether the SVC was acting with the mantle of command authority The only reason that matters is the burden with which the government must meet in order to rebut the appearance of UCI in the case. If the bad actor, and I don't say that with a value judgment, but if the bad actor is acting with the mantle of command authority, then the government bears the burden of disproving any harm beyond a reasonable doubt. But if the SVC was not acting with the mantle of command authority, the government still has water to carry, but they only have to meet their burden by a preponderance of the evidence that this was harmless. I would posit to Your Honor that the SVC was acting with the mantle of command authority. As Judge Speranza pointed out, the SVC testified that that this was a standard in practice, and the record is not entirely clear that that was that he was referencing the program's standard, but the gist of his, and taken in context, that appears to be what the SVC was saying, that this is a standard in practice. If this is a standard in practice for the Air Force Special Victims Council program, which is undoubtedly a government program, then when the SVC was doing, when the SVC was carrying the program's water, he was acting with the mantle of command authority. If this was a rogue SVC, then he was not, and we concede that. But even if he was acting on his own and not with the mantle of command authority, the government still has water to carry here. The government still has to convince this court that either the facts do not exist, which that they've been uncontested at this point, that that ex parte communication occurred, that the facts do not constitute unlawful influence, do not constitute a violation of Article 37. The way the government attempts to satisfy that is to say that this conversation was merely administrative in nature and not terribly important to the trial judge. But the facts of this case weigh against such a conclusion. The evidence is that the trial judge did care about this information enough to remember it throughout the trial and address it with trial defense counsel at the end of trial. So it was not insignificant to the trial judge. The third way the government could try to prove that the unlawful influence was harmless is to say that it did not affect the findings. And, of course, we have the trial judge making a finding, a special finding that the victim's credible. And this court cannot be convinced that that finding was not influenced by the improper ex parte information. So the appellant has met the burden of establishing facts which constitute unlawful influence, a violation of Article 37. The government has not met its burden to disprove that, and a remedy must be adjudged. And again, just like for the first issue, the case law does not bind this court's hands as to the appropriate remedy to be adjudged. But for the same reasons that I articulated with regard to the first issue, we urge this court to dismiss with prejudice in order to ensure that the public maintains confidence in military justice processes. That concludes my presentation. I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal, if I could, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Government counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Senior Judge Mayberry, honorable judges, may it please the court, I'm Major Ronnie Steelman, and I, along with Major Lance Smith, represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in not recusing himself sua sponte after the short pretrial conversation with the Special Victims Council. Furthermore, the same pretrial conversation did not constitute any kind of unlawful influence, neither did it have the appearance thereof. Now, before I start talking about the issues, I would also like to talk a little bit about the facts of this case and what happened. Appellant's brief paints this pretrial conversation as some kind of a secret meeting where the lying and conniving SVC tried to influence the military judge, followed by both of them actively seeking to conceal this from the rest of the other parties. And there's nothing that could be farther from the truth than that, from what happened. What we have here in this case is the morning of trial, the SVC had a 2 to 3 minute conversation with the military judge. They exchanged pleasantries, and the military judge talked to the SVC about procedures that he uses with SVCs, how he handles SVCs in the courtroom, just typical administrative things like where the SVC will stand when he addresses the court, and procedures like that. The judge then confirmed with the SVC whether he had seen any motions like 412, 513, if the military judge had missed those, if the SVC had seen something that the military judge had not, as far as motions that had been filed that would concern the SVC. And within that context of discussions of what motions had or had not been filed, the SVC mentions that the night before there had been an interview by the defense of the victim, and that there had been some disagreements about that interview, and that the victim had refused to answer certain questions that had been repetitive from before. And the purpose of that was to ask the military judge whether that issue had been raised at that point, because the defense counsel had told the SVC they'd be raising that with a judge. And so the SVC just wanted to know, has this issue been raised at all? Is there something I need to know about that? That was the purpose of that conversation.
And you believe that that is administrative?
Yes, Your Honor. And the purpose, again, and there was no mention of maltreatment at all in this at all. It was just basically, I do believe it was administrative. It was just in the context of the SVC trying to find out what motions had been filed so that he could know what his responsibilities, if there's something he needed to prepare for. So, yes, and that was in the context of talking about the 412 and the 513 motions.
So, counsel, to follow up, it may be that the purpose, would you agree that perhaps the purpose was administrative, but in pursuing that purpose, wouldn't it also be possible to bring substantive matters the judge may be called upon to evaluate or rule on?
Your Honor, I wouldn't necessarily call it substantive matters that he brought up at all. I would still call it administrative. It was just a brief reference to the fact that there was some kind of disagreement about this interview, and because of the questions that were asked, and the SVC asked, has there been anything filed about this that I need to know? The purpose of that was just to give context to what the SVC wanted to ask the military judge. And in answer to Judge Spronza's earlier question, the military judge did testify in the Article 39 hearing that this issue was brought up in the 802 with the parties later on, and that the defense counsel specifically told the military judge they did not want to raise this as an issue. So the military judge was aware of this from the 802 also, and that is on page 356 in the record.
So, counsel, let me just ask you, in your assessment, in which order did these discussions take place?
It's not completely clear, Your Honor, the order. It appears, I believe the military judge testified that he believed, even though he wasn't completely positive, he believed that the conversation occurred first with the with the SVC and then the 802 with the parties afterwards. But that's not completely clear on the record. Now I'd like to move on to talk about the actual first issue regarding whether the military judge should have recused himself sua sponte. And the overarching theme here is the fact that military judges have a strong presumption of impartiality, and that comes from the Quintanilla case. And also that case states that appellants face a high hurdle in claiming that a military judge should have recused himself for bias. And In order for this court to find that the military judge should have recused himself in this case because he was biased, appellant has several high hurdles also. The appellant needs to show that a reasonable observer would believe that this brief mention of this pretrial interview actually influenced the military judge, that this brief mention of the victim interview of some kind of a disagreement, that the military judge had to have blamed that on the defense counsel. And then that the military judge would have held that against the appellant and found appellant guilty because of that. And those are too many hurdles, and the appellant can't even jump one of those hurdles, let alone all of them. Military judges, by virtue of their position, are going to hear about disagreements that trial participants are going to have. That's not going to be something that's going to be significant or special or surprising to a military judge to hear that trial participants have some kind of disagreement about a pretrial interview. No reasonable person is going to believe that a military judge is going to hold that against a party that there was a disagreement. And especially in this case, based on what the SVC told the military judge, it's just as likely that the military judge might hold that against the victim because the victim was refusing to answer the defense counsel's questions, excuse me, and maybe then the defense counsel was being obstructionist. So that's just as likely as any possibility that the military judge would hold that against the defense counsel and in turn the appellant. We consistently ask military judges to make rulings on motions like 412, 513, motions in limine, and they commonly hear evidence and have to make rulings on whether evidence will be presented in trial or not, and maybe or motions to suppress evidence, and then they have to turn around and forget that and make findings and continue to make other rulings in the case. And it's not reasonable to think that this short 1 to 2 sentence part of this pretrial conversation with the SVC would have any influence at all over the military judge in light of what a military judge always does and what their job is. The Quintanilla case is also, there's a couple of cases that are instructive to this court. The Quintanilla case, which has been mentioned, is one of them. In that case, just briefly, the facts of this case, it's a very, very interesting case, and that's a very far end of the spectrum from what we have here. In that case, the military judge got into heated arguments and possibly even physical altercation with one of the witnesses. And got himself involved in trying to actually get another witness to testify in the trial. He also potentially became a witness and actively tried to make sure that the parties didn't call him as a witness. He had an ex parte conversation with the trial counsel about not just the order of witnesses, but had to do with how the evidence would be presented to the members about his interactions with this witness that he had previously had. And in that case, with all of that misconduct or potential misconduct that this military judge had, the court did agree that he should have recused himself, but they did not grant a reversal, but instead they still needed more facts, even on top of what they already had. And this case obviously is not even near to the facts in Quintanilla. But also the Elise case, which the United States cited recently in its supplemental citation, has facts very similar to this case, in that the trial counsel had discussions with the military judge, certainly more substantive than they had in this case, regarding whether or not a delay would be requested. And the military judge in that case didn't even mention at all to defense counsel that there had been any kind of meeting, as opposed to in this case where the military judge did make it clear, both in the 802 and on the record, that these discussions had occurred with the SVC. And in that case, the court found, in the Elise case, the court found that Because it was administrative in nature, the communications, and because there was no indication of bias from the military judge, and no prejudice to the appellant, they found that the military judge did not abuse his discretion. Now, if there's no further questions on that issue, I will move on to the second issue regarding the UCI. Now, appellant argues, first of all, that this constituted potentially unlawful command influence. And just briefly on that point, there's no indication that the SBC represented the command in any way in this case. An SVC represents a client whose interests may or may not even correspond with the interests of the government in a proceeding. The SVC belongs to a chain of command completely separate from those of other trial participants, and certainly doesn't belong to the command structure that is actually seeking to prosecute the case. And finally, as many cases have required for an issue of command influence, in this case there was no mantle of command authority as is required for unlawful command influence. As an example of when there could be at least the appearance of unlawful command influence, and this is just to compare, we've got the Sawyer case, which was cited in the United States brief. And in that case, the military judge had made a ruling that the government did not like. And so the trial counsel went, and he dug up dirt, essentially, on this military judge from his military personnel file, and then also had his boss, the SJ, make a phone call to the boss of the judge, his circuit, the chief circuit judge, I think, at the time, to complain about this judge's ruling. And in that case, the CAF held that constituted at least the appearance of unlawful command influence. And obviously in this case, with this SVC, he didn't make any threats to the military judge. He didn't even advocate for a position. He didn't ask for a ruling from the judge. He didn't ask for anything from the judge when he brought this up. It was solely with the purpose to find out some information, whether he needed to prepare for a motion that may or may not have been filed. In order, as we've discussed before, in order to prevail on a claim of unlawful influence, appellant show three things, and then potentially if the appellant can meet those three factors, then the burden shifts back to the government. But the first three factors the appellant must show is, one, facts constituting unlawful influence, that the proceedings were unfair, and that the unlawful influence was the cause of the unfairness. And because appellant can't even meet their initial burden, the United States doesn't even have to meet theirs. Because in this case, it's not reasonable to believe that a lieutenant colonel military judge would be influenced in any way by a captain SVC who is in the type of position that he's a regular trial participant, that the military judge has experience dealing with. And again, with this conversation that is so benign, that there's no possibility that the military judge could have been influenced by that conversation.
Counsel, let me just ask you to clarify. Is it your argument that an advocate in a military court-martial would not be in a position to influence the trial judge?
Oh, under certain circumstances, it could be possible, but specifically under these circumstances, what happened here? Again, certainly I talked about the Sawyer case, and that was a trial participant at the trial counsel who influenced the military judge with the actions he took. But in these particular circumstances for this case, no, I don't believe the SVC did anything that could have possibly influenced the military judge. And finally, the again, the second requirement is that the proceedings were unfair. And the record shows, and I would ask your honors to go and look through the record of trial to see how the military judge ruled on motions, how he treated counsel throughout the proceeding, and you'll see that this military judge was extremely fair to both sides. He ruled for both sides on motions. He was very fair in the way that he heard the case, that he treated counsel in the case. There's no indication that he favored one side or the other. And, in fact, he acquitted the appellant of one of the specifications, which certainly shows that he did not hold any bias against that appellant.
Counsel, in terms of influence, appellant's counsel has raised the military judge's conversation with defense counsel, and I believe also special victims counsel, post-trial, about the facts and circumstances surrounding the interview with the victim. Again, facts which, if true, do you believe that the pre-trial conversation did not in any way influence the military judge based upon his post-trial conversations and the content of those conversations?
Right. Yes, Your Honor, if I understand correctly, I don't think there's anything in those post-trial conversations, kind of the feedback sessions, is that what you're referencing? I don't believe there's anything in those post-trial sessions that shows that the military judge had been influenced in any way by what had happened. Obviously, the military judge was just providing feedback. He knew that this interview had been an issue, and he discusses in his testimony kind of why he brought that up with the counsel, and it was just to help counsel improve different things. He brought it up with various parties. And my last point would be the appellant has mentioned the special findings that the military judge made regarding the fact that this victim, who was represented by the SVC, was credible. But if you look at those special findings, they're very extensive, these special findings. And it's not just the victim that the military judge finds credible. It's almost all of the witnesses that were produced, including Sergeant, I think it's Bowling, was one of the defense witnesses. And the military judge found him credible. So there was no special treatment afforded to the victim in this case because of this contact. And unless there are any further questions, may I briefly conclude? No reasonable observer would believe that the short, administrative-related conversation between the military judge and the SVC could bias or influence the military judge in any way. As such, the military judge had no obligation to recuse himself in this case. Neither did this interaction constitute unlawful influence. The United States requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence.
Counsel, please proceed.
The government's counsel relies a lot on the testimony of the special victims counsel offered in the post-trial 39A session to account for the nature of this communication between the trial judge and the SVC prior to trial. For example, government counsel argues that that this court should accept the SVC's testimony that the communication was only 2 or 3 minutes, or that the government counsel's characterization that the SVC just briefly mentioned the fact that he'd complained about trial defense counsel's conduct, or the SVC and the government counsel says that mention was only one or two sentences. The problem for this court and the problem for the government is that it is improper for the military judge to pawn the responsibility off of characterizing and capturing that communication on a witness. It was the judge's responsibility to account for that communication and to relay it to Sergeant Turner so he could make the elections that he needed to make in that court-martial. We cannot rely on the testimony of a self-serving SVC who has motive to mitigate the sort of communication that he had with the trial judge ex parte without either party being present. In Quintanilla, the court found that it was improper for the judge to put the witness on the stand to describe the nature of their ex parte communications, that the judge had the responsibility of capturing that for the record, and that when the judge did not, that resulted in an unclear record regarding that ex parte communication, and that was problematic. That would make a reasonable observer question the judge's impartiality, that he would not come forward with his own accounting of that communication. That is a problem for the government, which it does not wrestle with.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. In the military judge's testimony at the post-trial 39A, he indicates that he doesn't recall the conversation with the SBC prior to trial. He remembers a discussion of the issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's his testimony that he didn't talk to the SBC before trial.
And the SBC testified that they had no post-trial feedback session.
But your position is that the judge had the obligation on the record to disclose the nature of his conversation.
Yes, prior to
the trial. And the facts before this court is that the judge had no recollection of such a conversation.
The post-trial 39A session, Your Honor, was quite a bit later. The judge had an obligation at the time of arraignment, at the time of the initial 39A session in the court-martial, to capture for Sergeant Turner the nature of that communication. Had he done so in the immediate aftermath of that conversation having occurred, then Sergeant Turner would have had a full accounting of the nature of that conversation and the opportunity to decide whether he wanted to waive a motion for recusal, whether he wanted to go judge alone, whether he wanted to litigate the case before that judge. It is the judge's failure to preserve that evidence, that communication, at the time that it was fresh in his mind that is problematic for the government. Yes, the judge could not recall months later in the post-trial 39A session what had occurred prior to trial, and that is a failure of the trial judge because he had an obligation to preserve it at the time the communication was made. The fact that the record is not clear regarding the nature of that communication, other than we know that Special Victims Counsel complained about how the defense counsel had been mistreating the victim during the pretrial interviews, but the exact details of that, to the extent that we don't have that, that is a failure of the government. Because the military judge is a government actor. The military judge is a judge advocate detailed for special duty, completely under the control of the judge advocate general, not appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, not a member of a separate branch of the government. That is an executive branch officer meeting with another executive branch officer, having improper communications regarding the complaining witness and then not telling the accused about it. This is a government failure. All parties involved in that failure were government actors.
And counsel, I think the military judge was asked why he didn't disclose these communications to the parties during, in court, after the pretrial 802 session he had with the parties. And the judge's response, as I recall, was that this matter was addressed with the parties in a pretrial 802 session, and that Civilian Defense Counsel had stated that it was not an issue, they did not intend to raise it at trial, and therefore the judge believed that it was not relevant further to the proceedings, and that's why he did not disclose those issues on the record. In summarizing the 802.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm over time. May I answer, Your Honor?
Of course.
Your Honor, I would posit to you that the judge's recollection at that post-trial 39A session, or that post-trial testimony, was not reliable. His memory was flawed at that time. But we do have a written record of the pretrial 802, which is unique in our practice. If you look at Appellate Exhibit 2, the judge actually, in writing, summarized that pretrial 802, and and there is no indication that there was such communication, at least to that extent. The reasonable person might give the military judge the benefit of the doubt in most cases, that the communication between the SVC and he prior to trial was not significant to him. But a reasonable person, having seen the military judge fail to disclose that communication at the time of trial, would not necessarily give that judge the benefit of the doubt. In fact, would not give that judge the benefit of the doubt. And the fact that the judge's memory was so defective at the time of the post-trial hearing would only make that reasonable observer less inclined to give the judge the benefit of the doubt. I want to address very briefly the A-list case that the government counsel brought up. In that case, the facts of that case are that defense counsel had filed a motion where he said that the trial counsel was consenting to the delay. I'm out of time. May I finish quickly, Your Honor?
Please, go ahead and quickly wrap up your point.
The defense counsel had brought it up. The defense counsel had filed a motion stating that the trial counsel consented to the delay. In that case, the military judge in Ailis reached out to trial counsel, believing, according to this court, that he must have been missing something in defense counsel's motion because there was nothing in writing saying trial counsel consented. Trial counsel then told him, we don't consent. And this court found that that communication was for scheduling purposes, which is specifically allowed by the Code of Judicial Conduct, communications in an ex parte manner for scheduling purposes. ALIS is completely inapplicable to this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, I want to thank you both for your arguments, and this court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.